Good afternoon. Thank you everyone for coming to hear me speak about pelvic floor dysfunction and how it relates to bowel dysfunction. I'm a pelvic floor physical therapist, and let me start by introducing myself. My name is Reva Prale. All these letters after my name mean that I'm a doctor of physical therapy. I'm a women's clinical specialist, which means that it's equivalent of being board certified in any given specialty within the PT community. So there are women's clinical specialists, pediatric clinical specialists, et cetera. So it's considered the gold standard of being a specialist in any given specialty. I'm board certified in biofeedback for pelvic muscle dysfunction, so I will be addressing biofeedback today. And I'm also a certified lymphedema therapist. Before I specialized in pelvic floor therapy, I worked for 3.5 years as a general outpatient orthopedic physical therapist. After that, I specialized and have been a pelvic floor physical therapist for the past 5 years, 2.5 of which have been as a clinic owner. Revitalized Physical Therapy is my business, which I opened 2.5 years ago. So do you guys want me to go over the anatomy of the pelvic floor? Do you guys feel like you've seen this, done this already many times in school? We can skip these slides, or I can do a quick review.
Quick review.
Okay, great. So there are 4 layers of muscular tissue, also known as diaphragms. One is the superficial perineal space, or pouch. It is the area which overlies the pelvic outlet, which includes the genitalia, the urogenital triangle, the anal triangle, and the perineal body. Then the second layer, and I have slides on each of those subsequently, would be the urogenital diaphragm, pelvic diaphragm, and the smooth muscle diaphragm. So a little more detail about each of those. Superficial perineal space, or pouch. So as you saw in the previous slide, this includes the genitalia, the urogenital triangle, which is bordered by the superficial transverse perineal muscle, which supports the lower end of the vagina and the introitus, the bulbo cavernosus muscle, which surrounds and strengthens the vaginal orifice, and it also constricts the urethra to eliminate the final drops of urine, and the bulbo cavernosus muscle, which maintains clitoral erection. Then there's the anal triangle, so where the urogenital triangle ends, the anal triangle begins. That is bordered anteriorly by the superficial transverse perineal muscle, posteriorly by the gluteus maximus muscle, sacral tuberous ligament, and coccyx. The anal triangle also contains the anal orifice, the anal canal, external and internal anal sphincters, ischiorectal fossa, and the pudendal canal, also known as Alcock's canal. The external anal sphincter is under voluntary control and surrounds the inferior end of the canal. Internal anal sphincters form from the inner circular muscular layer of the inferior anal canal and is under involuntary control. It relaxes when stimulated by the parasympathetic nervous system. And then the perineal body is just the area in between the vagina and the anus. Urogenital diaphragm contains the deep transverse perineal muscle and the sphincter urethra muscles, which contribute to voluntary control of voiding. Pelvic diaphragm. This contains the levator ani muscles and the coccygeus muscle. The levator ani muscle can further be subdivided into the pubococcygeus muscle, puborectalis muscle, and iliococcygeus muscle. The puborectalis muscle is particularly important and relevant for our conversation today because it is the muscle that swings around the rectum and helps control the descent of feces. It actually creates the anorectal junction or angulation, which I'll be referring to later on. The iliococcygeus muscle is often connected to the ischiococcygeus muscle, which tenses the pelvic floor, helps to stabilize the sacroiliac joint, and helps to nutate or flex the coccyx. And then the coccygeus muscle as well is considered part of the pelvic diaphragm. Then finally, we have the smooth muscle diaphragm. I'm not going to go into too much detail about this because you guys aren't urologists, you're GIs. Internal urethral sphincter and external urethral sphincter. Internal urethral sphincter is under involuntary or autonomic control of the sympathetic nervous system. The external urethral sphincter is striated type 2 muscle fibers, so it's actually under voluntary control of the somatic nervous system. Okay, so pelvic floor muscles. What is the pelvic floor? What does it do? It's basically a series of muscles that rest at the bottom of the pelvis. And it has several very important functions. Number one is these muscles provide support to the pelvic organs. So anterior to posterior, we have the bladder, uterus, and rectum. And those three organs are connected to the three openings within the pelvic floor. Again, anterior to posterior, the urethra, vagina, and the anus. So function number two of the pelvic floor muscles, which is extremely important, is that these muscles provide sphincteric control to the pelvic outlet, so maintaining bowel and bladder continence. Number three, these muscles are actively involved in sexual response. They provide tone to the vaginal and rectal canals. And these muscles also help the low back muscles and core muscles to provide stability, spinal stability. So I'm going to address now the concept of mobility versus stability. Too much of either is bad. Within our body, we want to strike a fine balance between mobility and stability. Because the organs in the pelvic floor are sacs that are intended to expand, empty, and move, for in our body, movement equals health. Should fibrotic changes or adhesions interfere with the organ's mobility, i.e. their ability to expand and to move, then certain symptoms, including constipation, urinary frequency, pelvic pain, pressure, or dyspareunia, which is pain during attempted penetration, may ensue. These are all associated with overactivity of the pelvic floor muscles when there's too much stability. So again, one end of the spectrum, having too much stability, not good. On the other hand, too much of the opposite extreme, i.e. mobility, is also not good. Because if there's too much mobility and not enough stability due to weakened or torn muscles or ligaments, then certain symptoms, including pelvic organ prolapse, such as rectocele, pelvic heaviness, or fecal incontinence, may ensue. These are often associated with underactive pelvic floor muscles, and we want to then put someone who has an underactive pelvic floor on an up-training program to help strengthen the pelvic floor muscles to restore continence or restore stability. And someone who has an overactive pelvic floor, we're going to get them on a down-training program, stretching, releasing, in order to help provide more mobility to a system that is too stable. Okay. So just a little quick more information about rectum and anal canal, which you guys probably know and can repeat back to me in your sleep. The rectum is contiguous with the sigmoid colon. The rectum starts at the level of S3 and extends 12 centimeters. It follows the curvature of the sacrum and coccyx, ending at the anal canal. The anal canal is 3 to 6 centimeters long, and it extends posteroinferiorly from the distal portion of the rectum. It contains the anal columns with mucosal folds, anal valves, and anal sinuses. Anorectal junction is the area where the rectum meets the anus, meets the anal canal, and this is where the puborectalis muscle slings around. And finally, along the lines of talking about all the hemorrhoids from the previous lecture, vascular supply, there are rectal arteries, one superior, two middle, and two inferior. Physiology, the gastrointestinal system, food enters through the mouth, goes through the esophagus, stomach, small intestine, large intestine, aka colon, onto the rectum, anus, and then out of our bodies. The colon receives 1,000 to 1,500 milliliters of material each day. Everything except for 100 to 150 milliliters is reabsorbed. And this small amount, which is not reabsorbed, is passed into the rectum as feces, and the normal rectal capacity is 150 milliliters. The amount of time that stool is spent in the colon is 24 to 72 hours. Fatty foods generally travel slower, and it travels through all three portions of the colon, namely the ascending, transverse, and descending portion of the colon. Stool enters the rectum, and what happens is that this triggers stretch receptors, and that triggers the urge sensation, and that's when we're aware that we need to defecate. It's naturally occurring urges, which is a lot more effective than straining, Valsalva maneuvering. Not healthy, not good. It confuses the pelvic floor muscles, can cause them to become tight. So therefore, chronic suppression of the natural defecation urge is very dangerous and can lead to constipation and or less effective emptying strategies. So one of the things that we always have to tell our patients is that when you feel the urge, as if it's socially appropriate and you're capable of doing so and not in the middle of a surgery, don't suppress the urge. So how do we know when it's time to go? Internal anal sphincter, smooth muscle, responsible for 50-85% of resting tone. External anal sphincter, responsible for 20-30%. The anal rectal fossa is responsible for the remaining 15% of resting tone. Now what happens is that rectal distension occurs. The puborectalis muscle has stretch receptors, which are stretched, sends the message to our brain, I'm feeling an urge. And what happens is there's initial relaxation of the internal anal sphincter along with contraction of the external anal sphincter. And this is called the sampling reflex. The sampling response, and it involves two reflexes, namely the RAIR, rectoanal inhibitory reflex, and the RAER, rectoanal excitatory reflex. So what happens is it's a little bit of Stool passes into the rectum, external anal sphincter contracts to keep it there because we're not ready to go yet, and then our brain determines what is in the rectum. Is this solid? Is this liquid? Is this gas? If it's liquid, external anal sphincter tone continues to increase to prevent loss of stool. Same with if solid material is entering, contraction of the external anal sphincter occurs to maintain continence until an appropriate time to pass a bowel movement. And if it's gas, then depending on if it's the person's in a socially appropriate place or not to pass gas, then they can decide to either increase or decrease the external anal sphincter tone. So again, a little more about the puborectalis muscle and the anorectal junction and what exactly happens during defecation. So the puborectalis muscle slings around the anal canal. This creates the anorectal junction. When the puborectalis and external anal sphincter relax, increases angulation, not decreases. The slide is wrong. It increases the angulation at the anorectal junction. So you see it goes from around 80 to 100 degrees to closer to here, it looks even like 180. But what happens when the puborectalis muscle relaxes is that it allows for increase in the anorectal junction, and you could see that this allows for smoother passage of bowel movement through the anus, as opposed to here where the puborectalis muscle is slinging around the anorectal junction. Like, think of it like tight reins around a horse, holding it back and causing this kink, which prevents stool to exit. So actually, this picture was taken from, are people familiar with Squatty Potty? It's one of Shark Tank's hottest hits. So Squatty Potty picked up on this, and yes, while they marketed it and made a cool cutout stool that can fit under your any stool can be used to create the same effect, which is basically allowing for increased hip flexion, and that allows for increased relaxation of the puborectalis muscle to allow for easier passing the bowel movements. Okay, so some colorectal conditions, which you're probably all very well versed in. Fecal or anal incontinence and constipation. These are the two, I'm going to be using these two as the paradigms. For fecal incontinence, is going to be the paradigm of underactive pelvic floor because it's often associated with weakness in the pelvic floor muscles. And then I'm going to go through what we as PTs do for up training and strengthening for fecal incontinence. Constipation is the paradigm of overactive pelvic floor. There's too much tightness, could be not only in the pelvic floor itself, but abdominal, low back, hips. And we're going to engage in a down training program. Now, all these other conditions, a lot of them are actually associated with overactive pelvic floor versus underactive. But anything which really is perceived by the pelvic floor muscles as a stressor or a trigger or something that the body doesn't want, the same way Dr. Maloney Patel was saying that the anus gets traumatized by constipation and diarrhea, so do the pelvic floor muscles, and they often respond by tensing and tightening and guarding as a protective mechanism, which can then cause pelvic floor muscle issues. So just to then, I'm going to go through these other conditions really briefly, and then there'll be more slides on incontinence and constipation. Pudendal neuralgia, coccyx disorders may ensue if the pelvic floor muscles are tight. It can pull the coccyx out of alignment. Pudendal neuralgia may be a colorectal condition that you encounter. Chronic pelvic pain or prostatitis. Hirschsprung's disease, which is a hereditary disease present from infancy. It's when the colon lacks nerve cells to innervate the musculature to propel stool through the colon. Irritable bowel syndrome, key hallmark, pain, altered defecation, bloating, can be diarrhea dominant, constipation dominant, or a combination of the two. Crohn's disease, inflammatory bowel disease, which affects the ileum of the small intestine. Symptoms are abdominal pain and diarrhea. Levator ani syndrome is very, very strongly associated with overactive pelvic floor muscles, and it's often described by patients as poorly localized pain in the pelvis. Proctalgia fugax is the equivalent of a heart attack of a rectum. And what it is it's decreased circulation to the external anal sphincter, which can result in sharp and fleeting pain in the rectum lasting 30 seconds to 30 minutes. So again, nitroglycerin could be used for treating proctalgia fugax. Hemorrhoids, varicosities in the rectum and the anus, those covered very extensively by Dr. Maloney Patel, so I don't need to go into detail about that. Fissures, tears in the anal skin, which can result in painful bowel movements. Fistulas, which is abnormal tunneling in the tissue due to infection or inflammation. So the tunneling can travel through canals, so if a person goes to the bathroom, they might be urinating and actually see fecal material, because if there's a tunnel from the rectum to the vagina, then they might notice that when they go to wipe after they've urinated. That requires medical intervention. There's nothing that I can do about that, unfortunately. Radiation burns due to cancer treatment can occur even up to 5 years post-treatment, and that can result in obstructed defecation. And finally, scarring due to any number of reasons, including surgeries, surgical scars. So now moving into the prime example that I encounter of underactive pelvic floor muscles, fecal or anal incontinence. This is the unwanted loss of stool, solid or liquid, or gas from the anal opening. It affects 5.5 million Americans, but bear in mind that this is grossly underreported due to shame and embarrassment, so the actual numbers are probably a lot higher. According to Rao in a study in 2004, 7.1% of individuals experience fecal soiling more than one time per month. So that is a very significant number. There are four types of fecal incontinence. Passive anal incontinence is when there is the involuntary loss of stool without awareness that there is any incontinent episode even occurring. They have no urge beforehand. And this is related to sensation damage and reflex damage. Urge anal incontinence is fecal incontinence despite active attempts to hold feces in after an urge is felt. That's often associated with external anal sphincter impairment or decreased rectal compliance. Fecal seepage incontinence is fecal incontinence after the passage of normal bowel movement due to incomplete emptying of the rectum. What happens here is the sphincters are intact, yet there's impaired sensation. So for example, if an individual has a rectal prolapse and the organ is misaligned and they sit on the toilet, they have their squatty potty, they think their puborectalis muscle is relaxed and released in their passing bowel movement, but the organ is flopped over and misaligned, then there may be rectal contents remaining. There may be feces that's still sitting in there. They get up to walk around 10 minutes later and, oops, what just happened? I thought I was done. So that may be due to a rectocele or a misaligned organ. And the fourth type of fecal incontinence is gas incontinence, symptoms of which include pain, bloating, and difficulty differentiating gas from stool. Causes of fecal incontinence can include pelvic floor muscle weakness, such as trauma from injury, such as during childbirth, the muscles get overstretched, or due to sexual abuse. Chronic constipation can lead to fecal incontinence. Sphincter failure, such as obstetric nerve damage or pudendal neuropathy. In addition, excessive bearing down while straining can not only cause hemorrhoids, but it also can result in a nerve overstretch injury or sphincter disruption, and that will result in fecal incontinence. Impaired anorectal sensations. If the stretch receptors located in the rectum and puborectalis muscle are overstretched, what happens over time is they get desensitized, and they're not going to notice as sensitively and as quickly that the rectum is filling. It doesn't feel like anything to them. So then the individual may experience fecal incontinence. In addition, decreased rectal compliance can result in fecal incontinence, as can chronic habitual suppression of the urge to defecate, as I mentioned earlier. This results in increased rectal filling, hardening of the stool, evacuation disorders, and diminished RAIR, the rectoanal inhibitory reflex. Rectal prolapse or rectocele can result in fecal incontinence, scarring such as surgery, radiation burns, tissue injury such as a fistula or fissure. Cognitive impairment, such as dementia or TBI, is associated with fecal incontinence, as is functional impairment. If an individual is not able to, if they have impaired ambulation, they can't get to the toilet in time, they have difficulty with their fine motor skills, and they can't doff their clothing in a timely manner, that can result in fecal incontinence. Constipation, prime example of overactive pelvic floor and overactivity. Most common GI complaint, as you probably all know very well by now. Associated signs and symptoms are decreased frequency, painful defecation, hard and dry stools, palpable abdominal mass, formed stool masses during rectal examinations, and abdominal pain. There are many diseases associated with constipation: Hirschsprung's, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's, stroke, spinal cord injury, diabetes, hypothyroidism, lupus, scleroderma, amyloidosis, the list goes on and on. So often there's a lot going on and comorbidities that are associated with constipation. And according to the Rome II definition of constipation, it's fewer than 3 bowel movements per week. In addition, the following criteria are met during more than 25% of defecations: lumpy and hard stools, sense of incomplete emptying of the rectum, sense of anorectal obstruction, use of manual maneuvers to facilitate removal of stool, such as splinting, that's when the individual inserts their finger vaginally to help empty their rectum. It may be caused by deficient fiber intake, lack of physical activity, medications often lead to constipation, dehydration, laxative abuse, chronic urge suppression, travel, IBS, or pregnancy. So there are a lot of things that are going wrong with people who have these conditions. And as PTs, we have a lot of goals that we want to help our clients achieve. So these are some examples of goals that I would write for my clients who come in and who we're trying to help. It's important for us as PTs to be mindful of our goals. It's important for the patients to know, because then if they have a goal in mind, it's easier to go through the process. And it's important for us to be able to communicate with you, with doctors, about what it is that we're doing with the patients and where we want to help your patients arrive at. So some goals include: patient will demonstrate comprehension of lower GI and pelvic floor muscle anatomy and function. Patient will decrease fecal incontinence episodes from 3 times a week to 0 times per week. Patient will increase bowel movement frequency to ideally 7 times a week without straining or pain, 1 time per day. But again, according to Rome, 3 is the minimum per week. Improve fiber intake to 30 to 35 grams per day. Improve sensation of urinary and/or bowel urge. Increase pelvic floor muscle endurance to ideally 30 seconds, because in order for an individual to activate the reflexes, they need to be able to contract the pelvic floor muscles for 30 seconds. So endurance training is very important. I'll elaborate on that in a little bit. And we also want to help the clients increase pelvic floor muscle awareness or ability to perform isolated contractions, i.e. without substituting their adductors or abdominals or glutes. You want to make sure that they're able to contract the pelvic floor muscles on their own. So before I even get into details about what a physical therapy and rectal examination looks like, I thought it'd be important to share the official position statement of the Section on Women's Health of APTA, the American Physical Therapy Association, regarding pelvic floor muscle examinations. The examination of pelvic floor muscles is consistent with physical therapy practice. It complies with national physical therapy policies requiring the performance of tests and measurements of neuromuscular function as an aid to the evaluation and treatment of a specific medical condition. So this very much falls within our scope of practice. Initial evaluations typically last 60 minutes. Indications for performing a pelvic floor physical therapy evaluation would be fecal incontinence, constipation, prolapse, anorectal pain, pelvic and/or coccyx pain, and even as an alternative to vaginal exams, such as if a client has dyspareunia. I have clients who come in and their pelvic floor muscles are really tight, and typically I will start by doing a vaginal exam rather than a rectal exam because they're generally tolerated better. But if individual has, say, proliferative neurovestibular dyspnea and increased nerve endings in the vestibule, which are extremely, extremely painful, and the individual can't tolerate a vaginal exam, so we can use a rectal exam as an alternative to a vaginal exam. We also do musculoskeletal screening. As musculoskeletal experts, this is the bread and butter of what we do. We want to assess the entire person, not just their pelvic floor, because rarely is the pelvic floor dysfunctional in isolation. Especially individuals who come with overactive, hypertonic, tight pelvic floor muscles, they usually have tight hips, low back, abdominal muscles as well. So in order to treat the entire person, we need to do a musculoskeletal screening and assess their hip flexibility, their low back flexibility and strength, the abdominals, and treat the individual as a whole rather than just a pelvic floor in isolation. In addition, we do an abdominal screening and perform palpation to assess tone and or trigger points, manual muscle testing of the abdominal muscles, and if there are scars, such as hysterectomy or C-section scars, we want to assess the scar mobility and adhesions. Scars are so under addressed. Like, as a pelvic floor therapist, I have people who come in sometimes a year, sometimes 5 years, sometimes 10 years, and they have scars that have never been touched because these people are so scared that if they touch their scar or if anything happens to it, it's going to open and they're going to need another surgery. Scarring is basically the body's natural way of healing itself, but sometimes the body does too good of a job and there's too much connective tissue and the scar can be really tight and be very adhesed and cause a lot of myofascial restriction in the region. So any abdominal surgery, it's very, very close to the pelvic floor. And as part of my pelvic floor treatment, I do scar work and I give the client scar massage for homework, because when that when the scar gets mobilized, it helps the pelvic floor heal faster. It's, again, part of the whole holistic treating the whole individual. In addition, we go through a complete history of bowel movement patterns and habits, as well as dietary profile. So I will literally sit there with clients and talk to them about their fiber, and they'll tell me they have no clue how much they eat. So I give them a bowel diary, and I have them track for the next week how much fiber they're eating, how are their bowel movements, how does the bowel movements get affected by increased fiber, as well as we want to then encourage them to also drink more water so that the stool can pass through the body more easily. Increasing fiber without increasing water is not a good thing, so we want to address both. But that is something that we'll review with clients to help point out to them that most people aren't getting enough fiber and how it can affect and improve their bowel movements by increasing fiber. Okay, so continuing along with the initial evaluation, we do both external and internal rectal evaluation. So the external component includes skin observations such as rash. We look for rashes, redness, any lesions, the skin integrity, look for hemorrhoids. You want to see if there are scars, skin tabs, dovetail sign, which is the absence of the anterior perianal folds, which is indicative of, anyone know? Dovetail sign? It's indicative of external anal sphincter defect. So that's something we look for. We want to also assess the perineal body, which is the area between the vagina and the anus, especially if women have had vaginal deliveries and they had either an episiotomy or a natural tearing, which healed on its own, aka scar. So that can very strongly be associated with pelvic floor muscle tightness. So we assess that as well. We can assess the coccyx externally and internally, as you see it's under both. We assess for pain, tenderness, asymmetrical sensation right and left. If there is not equal sensation, if it's not symmetrical, that's probably indicative of nerve damage. And we also check neuromuscular coordination. So I'll have patients, just while I'm still performing all external component of the exam, I'll have the patient try to contract the pelvic floor, try to relax the pelvic floor, try to bulge and bear down, to see if they have the ability to engage the pelvic floor upon request. And I also want to make sure that when the individual is performing a pelvic floor contraction, that they're not squeezing their abs or their glutes or their adductors, which a lot of people tend to do. It's interesting. I have a lot of people come in, and especially like my postpartum women who have incontinence, and they'll tell me, you know, I've done Kegels for 6 months and it didn't help me at all. 50% of people who think they're doing Kegels are performing them incorrectly because they're just substituting with other muscle groups instead of actually squeezing the pelvic floor. So best way to teach people how to perform a Kegel is with tactile cueing, and that's where the manual skills come in. So moving on to the internal rectal evaluation, double gloved, lubricated finger, palpate the external anal sphincter, internal anal sphincter, puborectalis muscle, iliococcygeus, sacrospinous ligaments, assess the tone, check for trigger points, see how much manual work needs to be done on the muscles that are tight. We also assess strength. So manual muscle testing, I use the Harvard or Oxford scale, which is 0 to 5. 0 is no palpable contraction, 1 is trace, 2 is poor, 3 fair, 4 good, 5 is strong. We also want to assess endurance, because again, goal of at least 30 second endurance is important for maintaining continence. I will also check for sensation and see if it's equal right to left internally. Tone assessment, is it normal, is it loose, asymmetrical, tight, tenderness and pain. Also check for the coccyx alignment, is it deviated right or left, is it nutated or counter-nutated. And we also check for rectocele and our prolapse. And I generally assess for prolapse while the client is in lithotomy position and or like supine, hook lying. And I assess vaginally. I'll insert 2 fingers and then push down, push posteriorly, and then have the client bear down so I can check for bladder under uterus prolapse, and then reverse the direction of my fingers and then have them bear down and see if there's any rectal prolapse. So I don't usually do that in like side lying, which is generally the position that I use for a rectal examination. Okay, contraindications or precautions to performing an internal rectal examination on a client would be if they're post-op within 6 weeks without your permission, because we don't want to mess up any surgery if you just did it, and we don't want to cause any damage to the client off of it. So minimum of 6 weeks post-surgery. If there's lack of consent, we need our patient's permission to do an internal rectal exam for obvious reasons. If there's an active infection, no examination, extreme pelvic pain, History of sexual abuse, that's more of a precaution. It's not something that I'm even always aware of on the first day. I do include it on my intake form. Some clients feel comfortable sharing, some clients don't. I try to just be really sensitive to all my clients in general, because most people who are coming in to see me would rather not. So I tell them, we're going to follow the pace of your body. I ask them like 14 times on the first day before I do anything, like, do I have your permission? And if you're uncomfortable at any point with anything that I'm doing, please communicate that to me, because you're in control of what's happening in this room, not me. And if the client doesn't feel comfortable with me, then they're not going to get better. Their pelvic floor muscles are going to just be tight, so it's going to be inaccurate results of the examination anyways. So yeah, very, very important to try to address the psychological aspect as well, to whatever degree that I, as a non-trained psychologist, can do. In addition, pregnancy. I've done internal work on clients who are pregnant with OB or midwife permission. I recently had a client who came in and she told me that she really, really wanted me to do internal work on her because her pelvic floor muscles felt really tight. She's pregnant, got permission for a midwife, it's fine. Children, never, ever, ever do we do internal work, ever. I do see pediatric clients, usually more for bowel issues rather than bladder. And obviously we never do anything internal with our pediatric population. When we do biofeedback with them, it's all external sensors. If an individual is bleeding from the rectum, we do not do an internal exam, maybe indicative of an active hemorrhoid. If there's radiation injury, the tissue may be really thin and we don't want to cause any more damage. Physical therapy treatment for fecal incontinence. So how can I help your patients? What do we as pelvic floor PTs do to help address fecal incontinence / underactive pelvic floors? And then I'll go into overactive pelvic floors and constipation. So first of all, there's a lot of patient education. We teach about toileting posture, about diet, about fiber, about what the stool consistency should look like. Are you guys familiar with the Bristol stool scale? So we want to teach them that we want their stool to look like a 4 and not a 1 or a 7. We also teach about skin care and bowel diary, as I mentioned earlier. Also encourage patients to make dietary changes, reviewing food triggers for diarrhea and gas, encouraging consistency with meals. Skipping meals isn't good, it slows down the whole system, so we want to keep them eating at regularly scheduled intervals. We also educate them about fiber, 35 grams per day according to the Surgeon General, along with 8 cups of water. We also educate them about the benefits of soluble fiber versus insoluble fiber. So soluble fiber soothes and regulates the digestive tract, and insoluble fiber hardens stool. So we want to make sure that they're having both. As a PT, of course, one of the things I'm going to do with clients is exercise, teaching them exercises. When it comes to underactive pelvic floors, we strengthen the pelvic floor. We want to get them on an up-training program to help strengthen their pelvic floor muscles so they'll be able to maintain continence. So we teach both two types of different exercises for the pelvic floor, because there are two different types of muscle fibers in the pelvic floor. Pelvic floor is comprised 70% of the pelvic floor, slow twitch type 1 fibers, 30% fast twitch type 2 fibers. I like to call the slow twitch fibers the marathoners, or the endurance exercisers, and the fast twitch fibers are more of your sprinters. And those are the ones that you feel a sudden urge and you need to be able to hold it in. Those are your fast twitch fibers that you're calling upon. So we do both quick flick exercises, which is training more of the fast twitch fibers, as well as endurance contraction, which trains the slow twitch fibers. We also teach individuals exercises for the core, because the pelvic floor and the core are so interconnected, and it's actually really hard to isolate pelvic floor contraction from an abdominal contraction. So I want to make sure that they're not substituting and only using the abs. I will allow them to use the abs while using the pelvic floor, and I'll teach them core strengthening exercises to facilitate pelvic floor strengthening. We want to also work on increasing the speed of recruitment. If an individual has the ability to contract the pelvic floor, but really slowly, that's not going to help them functionally, so we're going to work on that with them. And we can use the biofeedback for that, as I'll go into later. We also teach a little cool trick called the knack, which is squeeze before you sneeze or cough or laugh. Any activity that involves increased intra-abdominal pressure puts pressure on the pelvic organs and will promote incontinence on a system that's already compromised. So we want to teach individuals how to contract the pelvic floor muscles in anticipation of increased intra-abdominal pressure to help maintain continence even throughout an additional stressor to the system. We also teach individuals how to...
That doesn't sound easy to do.
The squeeze before you sneeze? Yeah, it's not easy to do. I challenge you. Try it. It's.
That's kind of like doing that thing like this.
Yeah, and that's where biofeedback is so great, because a person can see on the screen, I'll have them like fake a laugh, or I'll just have to tell a funny joke and make them laugh, but like they'll have to do a Kegel before they start laughing, and they need to see the line go up before they're actually coughing or sneezing or laughing. And it's training, it's coordination. That's more of a coordination thing than it is like just go do a, you know, bicep curl. So yeah, it is definitely challenging. I also teach individuals about proper and complete relaxation of the pelvic floor muscles, because this is an issue which I see often. A person will do a pelvic floor muscle contraction and then they'll think they're relaxing and releasing, but they're not. So I use an elevator analogy with them. I'll tell them your pelvic floor should be able to be zero at rest, fully relaxed and released, and then you have the ability to squeeze and bring it up to a 10, bring that elevator up to the 10th floor, and then relax and release and bring it all the way back down to floor zero. What happens when a person doesn't relax completely, let's say they release the elevator from floor 10 down to floor 5, is that any subsequent contraction that they try to do is not going to be as efficient or effective as a contraction that was starting at zero. The muscles need to relax and release fully in order to then function optimally on subsequent contractions. So you have to do a lot of education on how to also relax the pelvic floor after you've contracted it. And for clients like that, I'll give them a 1-to-2 ratio of work to rest, so 5-second contractions, 10-second relaxation, until we could see them being able to relax and release more quickly. And then we'll progress them by doing a 1-to-1 ratio and eventually a 1-to-2 ratio. So, yeah. In addition, as a manual therapist, there's always manual therapy to do, especially if the individual who comes in with an underactive pelvic floor also has tight muscles. What's that you say? Fecal incontinence, that's underactive, weak pelvic floor muscles, right? Those muscles are going to be overstretched and weakened, right? Not necessarily. Many, many people who come in presenting with incontinence issues, bowel or bladder, actually have really tight pelvic floor muscles. And because the muscles are tight, they're weak. Muscles can be weak if they're overstretched or if they're too tight. So again, we want to first stretch the muscles, bring them down to a better resting tone, and then strengthen, because we always have to stretch before we strengthen. Again, we always stretch the muscles before we strengthen, because if we try to strengthen a system that's already tight and overactive, we're not going to be doing that system any favors. So I do manual work on muscles that are tight. I teach patients how to do stretching on their own, such as with dilators or a TheraWand if the muscles are really tight. And then we could get them on a strengthening program. And that's also a very common misconception that I have to dispel this myth to a lot of my clients when they come in on the first day. And they tell me they have pelvic problems, they have pelvic pain, they have issues. They like Googled it and WebMD'd themselves and know they need physical therapy. And they also saw like, oh, Kegels are a thing. So let me Kegel, right? And they come in and they have these overactive tight pelvic floors and they think they're helping themselves by doing Kegels. I'm like, no. Abort mission. You do not do any Kegels, even though you're experiencing a little incontinence. It's because your muscles are really, really tight. You need to stretch them, and chances are the incontinence is going to resolve on its own when we get those muscles back to a healthier resting tone in and of themselves. And if not, then I can get them on a strengthening program. If the down training component isn't sufficient, then we'll also include an up training program. But I have to tell my patients, like, stop, no Kegels for you. In addition, we do biofeedback, and I will have a bunch of slides on that later on, so I'm going to hold off on that. Electrical stimulation to improve and strengthen the proprioception for patients who need additional facilitation to activate the pelvic floor. This is literally people, I'm talking about people who come in and they have no clue with all the tactile facilitation. I have them like doing cheating techniques. I have people like flex their toes because the toe flexors come from the same sacral nerve as the pelvic floor muscles, so that sometimes helps people with performing pelvic floor contractions. If the individual seriously has no clue and no concept, and they have an intact nervous system, so we want to make sure that the reflexes are all there, then on rare occasion I'll use electrical stimulation to help facilitate pelvic floor muscle contractions. I maybe have used it on 2 or 3 patients because it's really not pleasant having stimulation into one's vagina So I try to avoid it. It's also expensive because they have to then purchase a sensor. So that is something I try to avoid. Please, please send your patients to me before it gets to that point where they're so bad that they have no clue how to even like contract the pelvic floor. That's usually a good sign that they need physical therapy. Finally, balloon techniques. This is like similar to the manometry. This is actually a really cool, fun technique that I have used with patients. It's to help retrain sphincter reflexes and to increase rectal filling sensitivity. So what I'll do is I'll say to the client, okay, we're going to play a game. I'll insert a balloon, and I'll say, okay, we're going to play a game. I want you to tell me, am I filling the balloon or am I emptying the balloon? And it's like shocking how many people can't distinguish between is the rectum being filled or emptied with air. And once clients start improving, then they'll notice, oh, yeah, that was filling. Oh, that was emptying. And then I'll challenge it further by only doing like 10 milliliters of air difference versus 20 milliliters difference. So that's a way to monitor progress, to monitor their increased sensitivity to rectal filling. And I'll also keep track of when is the initial urge sensation occurring. Does the rectum require 100 milliliters of air for them to feel anything? Or they're improving and now only 50 milliliters of air are required for them to feel an initial urge. So that's a cool way to help retrain the sphincter reflexes and rectal filling sensation. Okay, so that was the underactive pelvic floor. Now we're going to do overactive pelvic floor. Manual, manual, manual. It was like number 4 on the last slide. It's number 1 here because these are... Yeah. Yeah, I sometimes will have the client then try to, especially individuals who have a difficulty with bearing down and bulging, like people who are performing, say, paradoxical contraction, which is when the individual thinks that they're bearing down and bulging, but they're actually contracting the pelvic floor, which is counterproductive to being able to pass a bowel movement. So I'll try to train them how to perform bulging, bearing down by expelling the balloon, or if I'm not using the balloon, then with my finger, as a way to help them feel the difference between contracting, tightening, pulling up and in, versus expelling.
And each session, how long do you work with them? Each session?
The
biofeedback, I mean.
Oh, so generally my sessions are 60 minutes. 45 to 60 minutes, yeah.
And how many times a week do you bring them?
One time a week.
One time?
One time a week. Versus general orthopedic PT, which is 2 to 3 times a week. Right. I give my clients a lot of homework.
Okay.
And I want to give them the time and ability to actually perform it. I really believe that people who feel empowered with their own healing process are going to get better faster. So rather than making them be dependent on me to come in and me do my whole thing with them and then send them home, I send them home with a lot of work. And they see that they get better when they actually do the homework. Plus, it's hard for a lot of people to come in. People, especially in New York, I work in New York, busy schedules. The PT there, this is a specialty, so it's more expensive than general PT. A lot of pelvic floor PTs aren't in network, so out of financial sensitivity to my clients, I'll try to make the sessions once a week and give them a lot of work that they could do on their own to progress their healing process. But yeah, like 60-minute sessions once a week, generally.
How many sessions do you end up doing usually to get them to that point where they're functioning on their own?
Good question. So I like to tell my clients that some people heal faster than others, some people will notice differences faster than others, but most people will start to notice significant improvements within 6 to 8 visits, especially if they're on an up-training program, because from a muscle physiology perspective, it takes 6 to 8 weeks for changes within the muscle fibers to occur, for increasing the number of muscle cells, for increasing their capacity to perform work. We do need to give it some time for them to actually, for their body to make those changes. There are people who come in with overactivity. It really, really is associated with how chronic the problem is. I like to tell my clients, let's give at least 1 month per year that you've been in pain. I have people come in and they've been in pain for 4 years, 5 years, 10 years. So obviously the individual who's been overactive pelvic floor for 10 years is going to need a lot more work than someone who it's more acute.
And since you touched upon the point of like the financial aspect, do most insurance cover biofeedback, pelvic floor physical therapy, or is it usually an out-of-pocket expense to the patients?
Good question. The whole biofeedback billing thing, it's very complicated. Last that I looked into it, I was under the impression, so let's use Medicare as the guidelines because pretty much everyone else ends up following Medicare in the end. Medicare won't reimburse for the unit, if the code used is the biofeedback code,
yeah.
They won't reimburse until there's been at least proven that the client has been coming for a month of other treatment and it hasn't helped. Now they need the biofeedback. We're like, I'm not going to wait a month to use biofeedback that's going to help my client. So we can't bill for biofeedback and have them get reimbursed for it according to Medicare unless if everything else has failed for a month. So most pelvic floor PTs who use biofeedback bill it for neuromuscular re-education rather than biofeedback.
And then, so it is covered by the insurance company, the patient's copay, like a standard whatever copay that they normally pay to a specialist.
Yes, it's not like an additional fee that we charge if we're going to be including biofeedback in the services.
Okay. And then if it ends up being an out-of-network or for whatever reason their insurance company doesn't cover biofeedback or pelvic floor physical therapy, what's like a roundabout figure that they would expect to pay, especially per treatment, if it's going to end up being a 3 to 4 month thing? Like, I think our patients are going to ask us, how much is it going to cost me if it's going to take, say, 3 to 4 months to kind of help?
Sure. So generally, I find that city PTs charge a little more than Jersey PTs.
Yeah.
I've seen the rates in New Jersey be like $150 to $200 for an hour session once a week, and for New York, I'm actually on the lower end. I charge $200 per an hour visit. The eval is $250. Subsequent 1 hour visits are $200. I have a west side location. It's a little more because my rent's a little higher. But there are people who charge like up to $300 and more for per session in the city. Yeah. So again, that's why once a week. And I'll tell a lot of the people coming, unfortunately, have a lot of other. They're seeing therapists, especially
yeah.
if they have like sexual dysfunction and it's affecting their intimate relationships. A lot of people are seeing other healthcare providers and they kind of get like, oh, I know I need to be like putting aside money for this. And other individuals who like don't have overlay pretty much, they, I'll offer a discount because I care more about being able to help people. For me, it would be nice to like make money while I'm in it, but like my primary thing is to be able to help people. So when I have a client coming and telling me like, I can't afford it, so I'll offer them a sliding scale. Any other questions up until now? Okay, cool. Yeah, I love questions. So manual therapy, we do a lot of manual therapy on individuals who have overactive pelvic floors. They often have tight hips, low back, everywhere else. So we do internal work as well as external work. Believe it or not, I spend majority of my session, aside from the subjective portion, with my hands on my clients. I'm stretching them, I'm doing external work, I'm doing internal work. But believe it or not, 2/3 to 3/4 of my session is spent doing external work because these clients often need a lot of external work. Plus, who wants an hour of internal work being done on them? I mean, really, I'd have no clients. So we do external work, which includes soft tissue work, myofascial release, deep friction massage, skin rolling, strain counter strain, muscle energy techniques if there's misalignment in the pelvis, and visceral mobilization. I happen to not be trained in visceral mobilization. There are other PTs who are. Internal work, there's a technique called Beal's massage, which is where the finger is moved with moderate pressure laterally in contact with the soft tissue of the coccygeus, levator ani, and gluteus maximus muscle in a 180 degree arc to really release the tension within the muscles. We could also do trigger point release work, coccyx mobilizations. Strain counter strain is like one of my favorite techniques for treating trigger points. So yeah, so that's all the manual component of therapy for overactive pelvic floor. We also do abdominal wall massage or I Love View, ILU massage. Are you guys familiar with this one? Oh, there'll be a slide on that. It's one of my favorites. Biofeedback. For overactive pelvic floor, I like to use two channels and have a channel connected to the abdominals and a channel connected to the pelvic floor because we want to make sure that they're pushing from the right place. Again, this paradoxical contraction. If a person's trying to pass a bowel movement, but they're contracting the pelvic floor instead of relaxing it, they're not going to be passing any bowel movement. So we want to teach the individual how to turn the pelvic floor off and keep it relaxed and released while engaging the abdominals to push from the right place while keeping the pelvic floor relaxed. So it's a nice option that we have the biofeedback to have two channels. Exercises will be prescribed for individuals with overactive pelvic floor. We'll get them on a daily aerobic exercise program to get things moving. We want activities that promote trunk elongation and abdominal stretching, as well as relaxation. We'll teach them core exercises, like TA, to help push from the proper place. And we'll also teach them dilator or TheraWand stretching for internal self-massage work at home. In addition, we will do a lot of education on food and fluid, just as we did with underactive pelvic floor and defecation mechanics. And we also do diaphragmatic breathing training. This is probably one of the first things I do with all my clients, underactive, overactive, especially when I'm doing an internal exam on someone for the first time, and they're all stressed out and they're like, what's happening here? So I will teach them how to do diaphragmatic breathing, which is inhaling slowly through the nose for 5 seconds and exhaling slowly through the mouth for 5 seconds. So I want you guys to try it on yourself. I always give my patients a pop quiz on the first day, so why not give it to you guys? In what direction do you think your pelvic floor moves while you're inhaling, taking a nice slow inhalation through the nose for 5 seconds? Does the pelvic floor move up or down? Good. Excellent. And it's counterintuitive. Most people think like inhale up, but it's actually inhale down, because as the abdomen is filling with air, think of it like a balloon filling up or like a grape expanding versus like a balloon emptying or a raisin. Air is now occupying the abdomen, and that pushes the pelvic floor muscles lower down. Contrast that with exhalation. Air is leaving the abdomen. Space is recreated once again, allowing the pelvic floor muscles to rise and return to their starting position. So that's exhalation is coupled with rising the pelvic floor. So I'll teach patients, inhale is the open, releasing, lengthening, relaxation phase. Exhalation is the rising, shortening, contraction phase. So if an individual is doing Kegel exercises, I teach them to squeeze on the exhale, because that's when the pelvic floor is rising and shortening. I'll teach them to release on the inhale. So just helping connect people with their pelvic floor, what it's doing. Most people are totally unaware of the very existence of their pelvic floor, let alone how it moves when they breathe, until they meet me. Because we just don't think about our pelvic floors when they're doing what they're supposed to be doing. It's only when they're not that we're like, what's happening? So teaching people how to connect with their pelvic floor is really important, and how to breathe properly in relation to the exercises that I'm teaching them. It helps to facilitate the homework that they're doing and the work that I'm doing with them. And part of, just going back to defecation mechanics, part of that is we teach proper sitting, feet on a stool, you want some hip elevation to allow for relaxation of the puborectalis muscle, and also to never, ever, ever delay the urge, because as we said earlier, chronic urge suppression can lead to problems. Okay, so this is ILU, or the I Love You colon massage, which I love and give to most of my clients who have constipation, probably all of them. The purpose is to facilitate colonic transport, ideally to be performed within 30 minutes after eating, because at that point in time, the colonic response is happening. There's increased peristalsis, so we want to piggyback on that naturally occurring process to promote colonic transit. We educate patients on the anatomy and physiology of the large intestine, so we tell them about their ascending colon, the transverse colon, and the descending colon. Why is it called ILU, or I Love You? Because we have them draw, stroke 15 I's down the descending colon, then 15 L's, from their perspective it's an L, so reverse L for you, along transverse and descending, and then a U, ascending, transverse, descending, ascending, transverse, descending, 15 times. With a fair amount of pressure. I will do this on patients in a session. I will give this to patients as part of their home exercise to do at home. And it's really effective, really effective. And we also teach them the colon is a one-way street. We want to make sure they're only going this way and not that way. And we teach them that we want to clear distally, work our way first distally, and then move backwards, and then go on to more proximal sections of the colon. A little more elaboration on toileting posture and positioning. So this is too natural, this is too unnatural, too much squatting. This is perfect. They have it right in third world countries where everyone squats to pass a bowel movement. So putting a stool underneath, allowing for increased hip flexion, leaning forward, not slouching from the back, but just hinging forward from the hips, forearms on the knees, nice breathing. I teach people to do diaphragmatic breathing and to really focus during that inhale release phase, and to then be pushing from the abdominals. Another trick that helps patients learn how to push from the proper place is to tell them to do belly big, belly hard, and that often helps people learn how to push properly. We also teach white front to back for sanitary purposes, avoiding straining. That's like the key, as you all heard with regarding hemorrhoids earlier. If there's nothing coming, get up, go about your business, and try again at the next urge, because all it means is that if your body isn't ready yet to pass the bowel movement, trying to push it prematurely is going to just confuse your pelvic floor muscles and not be good for anyone. So now I'm going to go into some slides on biofeedback, which is awesome. And I joke around with some of my friends. I became a pelvic floor therapist because I got to play with cool computer games with my clients, such as biofeedback, which is really great. I'm going to slide forward just a couple, just to show you like what it looks like. So here is times. This represents how much time has elapsed. This represents microvolts, because biofeedback measures the electricity generated by the muscles while they're contracting. And then we can see how high is it going when they're squeezing, and then can they release. So what biofeedback is it's to help teach proper muscle recruitment, relaxation, isolation, and discrimination. It's a technique in which a typically unconscious physiological process is presented to the patient and therapist as visual or auditory signal. The signal is displayed on the screen, as I showed you on the slide, in a quantitative way, and the screen can be either on a laptop, or there's even like a handheld device, which is more basic, not as detailed, but if I'm doing a home visit and it's easier to use the handheld device rather than bring a whole laptop, then it is equally effective in teaching people how to squeeze and release. And the signal is displayed on the screen. The patient is educated on how to alter it and thus control the basic physiological process. I use external sensors. There is an option for internal sensors, either vaginal or rectal. Most people prefer superficial because it's more comfortable. It's also a lot cheaper. So from a financial perspective, I'd rather not charge them $60 for an internal sensor if we can use disposable sensors externally that cost next to nothing. So surface EMG, I'm going to discuss that because that's what I do. Recording the muscle activity from the skin surface. The surface EMG signals received at the electrode and carried by lead wires to the unit. The signals then amplified, converted, and presented back to the patient. The surface EMG signals can be controlled by adjusting the type of signal, either auditory or audio signs or visual signs. The patient can hear or see depending on what type of learner they are. Most people are visual learners and they prefer being able to see it. The biofeedback is used for monitoring skeletal muscle tension and to provide feedback. It assesses the magnitude and timing of overall muscle contraction and relaxation. The benefits of surface EMG: non-invasive, painless, easy application, able to test in functional positions, and enhanced motivation. Patients find it really fun to do. Limitations: we're unable to isolate one muscle because it records the sum of voltages. In addition, we can only monitor superficial muscles, so we can get the external sphincter, but we're not going to be able to see what the pubococcygeus is doing. Electrode preparation and placement. We use small electrodes are always better than large ones because you can be more specific with them, despite even if there's poor contact. The external perineum should first be cleaned with either a moist towelette or a towel and some clear water. The active electrodes are applied parallel to the fibers of the target muscle over the largest muscle bulk. And we want to put them as close together as possible to minimize crosstalk and to increase specificity. The recommended perianal placement is, so imagine a clock around the anus, 2 and 7 o'clock or 11 and 5 o'clock. You want to avoid skin puckering, and we want to place the electrodes over intact skin. And there's a third electrode, which is the ground electrode, which is placed equidistant from the active electrodes or near a bony prominence, such as the SAS or the ischial tuberosity. What we measure: baseline resting EMG. So this is where the elevator analogy comes in, and I love using this with my clients. The pelvic floor at rest should be 2 microvolts or below. Okay, so if a patient comes in and we hook them up to biofeedback and I want to see what they're doing, just while they're chilling out and doing nothing at rest and they think they're relaxed, if their pelvic floor is at like 5 or more, that's telling me that they're holding a lot of tension in those pelvic floor muscles. So baseline resting EMG tells us a lot of information just from the start, before we even have the client do anything with the biofeedback. Then I'll have the client perform a contraction and see what is their peak EMG amplitude. How high can they bring the line on the screen? EMG measures muscle activity through the electricity conducted via the action potentials. It does not directly muscle strength. However, we can correlate muscle activity with strength. We can also look for the speed of initiation. Does it take them some time to get that line up? Or when I ask them to contract, they can bring it up nice and smooth. We also check for endurance. How long can they hold it? 5 seconds, 10 seconds, or are they... Plateaus are indicative of nice, good endurance contractions, or are they kind of like fading away after 5, 6, 7 seconds? So we can check their endurance, and they can see it in a very real and tangible way. We also check for their recruitment patterns. Do they have difficulty relaxing the pelvic floor muscles after they've performed a contraction? So again, when they bring it up to a 10, is it getting stuck at floor 5 rather than bringing it down to floor 0? Are contractions inconsistent? We want to see how they're able to squeeze and release fully. And what's so interesting with so many clients is that they have this aha moment. So many people have no clue what is happening within their pelvic floor, and they think they're squeezing, but they're not. And then when they squeeze from the proper place, they're like, oh, that's what it feels like to do a pelvic floor muscle contraction? Who knew? And then when they release, I'm like, oh, individuals who have, let's say, overactive pelvic floor, and I put them on biofeedback to show them, look, this is, you're at a 10 at rest. This is you chillaxing. Like, we need to get you, like, down to here. And I teach them how to do a pelvic drop, how to release within the pelvic floor. I'll teach them how to bear down or bulge slightly. And then they're like, wait, that's what it means for my pelvic floor to be relaxed and released? I'm like, yeah, that's where your pelvic floor wants to be. And for them, it feels so abnormal to them. They're scared, like, their insides are going to come out if they do that, because that's just what they've been so used to for so many years. And I use posture as an analogy, and I'll tell them, you know how many people come in to see me, let's say before when I was doing general orthopedics, cervical patients, they come in here like this, and this feels comfortable to them, but I teach them about proper posture and what they need to do to help prevent their muscles from going into spasm and ruining their shoulders and having lots of issues down the road. All of a sudden, they're in proper posture, and it feels really weird, but it's going to be good for them in the long run. It's what your body wants, even though it feels really unnatural and weird now. Same with your pelvic floor posture. Right now, this feels weird for you to relax your pelvic floor. To you, you're comfortable like this, but it's not good for your body. And you know how you know that? Because you're in pain. And pain is a sign that your body's trying to get your attention. Your body wants to be like this. So even though it feels unnatural, it will feel natural with time, and it'll also feel a lot better for you and your body. Okay. So just some general biofeedback guidelines. We want to document the position for standardization and comparison purposes. If the client is uncomfortable, we can first test it out on an extremity and explain the concept, show them what happens to their biceps when they're squeezing and releasing. We want to make sure the screen is easily visible. We explain the rationale behind using the biofeedback and what they should expect. We want to set achievable goals. Make sure that we're giving them adequate rest breaks, so 1 to 2 if they're first starting and having trouble bringing that elevator down. We want to encourage independent thinking and problem solving. We want to bring to their attention, what does it feel like when you're letting go? What does it feel like when you're squeezing your pelvic floor? To help create a mind-body connection and increase proprioception and awareness of what they're doing within their pelvic floor. Like I said, many people lack awareness, so we want to help increase their awareness and know what, have the client recognize what they're doing within their body at any given moment. We want to also be mindful if there's been any previous abuse, trauma, surgery, scar tissue, or pain upon intended contraction, that would may further complicate using biofeedback with the client as it would complicate doing manual work, so we want to just be mindful of all of that. We want to keep it simple for starters and use imagery. So I love the imagery, like the different verbal cues that different people respond to. It's so interesting. Some people, they hear the elevator, they connect with it, they get it. Other people respond to different cues. So some of the cues that I will provide is pull up and in, lift and hold your pelvic floor up like a hammock, try to prevent the passage of gas, pull up towards your belly button. I'll even place my hand on the low back and on the umbilicus, and I'll tell them, imagine there's a wire between my two hands. Try to tighten the wire while lifting the hammock. So that's to engage the abdominals and the pelvic floor at the same time. And another analogy I like to use is, imagine there's a fist squeezing around the hose. So for my underactive clients, who I'm trying to get them to perform a contraction, imagine you're trying to squeeze that fist around the hose to prevent the flow of water from one end to the other. The overactive pelvic floor, I'll teach them there's a fist squeezing around the hose. You're not able to water the plants. You want to try to open that fist as you're inhaling, releasing. Inhaling, releasing. With each inhale, release, imagine they're opening that fist up around the hose even further, and that is something that some people relate to. Or an analogy of, imagine there's a flower and the petals are opening one by one with each inhalation. We're going to also educate patients on how to coordinate the breathing with the pelvic floor. So exhale, squeeze, inhale, release. We'll have people do home, once they've done the biofeedback, they're aware of how to squeeze, how to release. We'll then give them homework, frequency of the homework, 1 to 2 times a day, doing pelvic floor muscle contractions, relaxations, and position. We're going to start in gravity assisted, such as supine knees to chest, or gravity eliminated, such as supine. Move on to anti-gravity, such as standing, and then onto functional positions. I will have people hooked up to the biofeedback and bring a little stool into my office and have them practice going up and downstairs while keeping the line up on the biofeedback. So we're training endurance contractions, we're training functional activities. I'll have them do squats, I'll have them do lunges, lots of different functional activities to make sure that the strengthening carries over to activities of daily living. Because for them to strengthen their pelvic floor in isolation, that's lovely, but for them to then be able to remain continent during their activities of daily living, that's the real goal. So that is what we like to do with biofeedback. All right, so thank you all for being such attentive, wonderful listeners and having such great questions. Are there any other questions that I can help with, answer?
Are your clients usually coming to you after having had some sort of study, like a topography or interferometry or something like that?
So a lot of them do. Yeah, a lot of them have had a lot of testing done on them before they come. Unfortunately, not all doctors are in the know, as you guys now are, about the existence of pelvic floor PT, and a lot of people are just bounced around and misdiagnosed for many years before they get an accurate diagnosis and referral to PT. So I have patients, a very, very common subjective report I'll hear, a person will come in, they've been to 8 different doctors over the past 5 years, they've had this test, that test, this MRI, that exam, this manometry exam, everything's negative, and the doctors can't find anything wrong with them. And I have clients who come in and they'll be like, yeah, the doctor just told me, like, take a Xanax or to, like, have some red wine and that'll help me relax. This is, like, something I hear often. And I'm like, no, your muscles are tight and you need pelvic floor physical therapy. You need manual work done. You need home exercises that are going to help stretch these tight muscles. So oftentimes people have gone for exams which are actually negative. Very few people come in and they've been referred because it has come up on the exam that there is rectal decreased sensitivity, and now they need to go to a physical therapy for like a balloon manometry, the fill the balloon, empty balloon game type of thing. So most people have had a lot of workups, but just inaccurate referrals.
Do patients find you through insurance, or is this like a Google search location?
So a lot of people find me through. I've had like such crazy stories of how my clients come to me. One patient, her mom was sitting next to me while I was doing work at Starbucks one day, and she saw I was working on some marketing stuff. Oh, what do you do? I told her what I did. I think my mom would benefit from your work. Other clients, Google, internet, a lot of people are finding out about physical therapy on their own because there is now a lot more. We have a much greater presence on the internet, on social media. There have been articles written about it.
They call their insurance company and see if like a pelvic floor PT is covered? Or?
A lot of people try, and unfortunately not many pelvic floor PTs are in network. There are some hospitals that have pelvic floor PTs on staff, like as part of their outpatient orthopedic practice, they have pelvic floor specialists. It's not super common. It's not like, it hasn't become the norm yet. I do think that that is what eventually will happen. As people realize more and more how important this work is, I think hospitals will want to build programs built into the hospital so that they can provide these services to patients. Actually, at my first job, where my 3.5 years of general orthopedic, I knew I wanted to be a pelvic floor PT. I was taking all my continuing education classes towards pelvic floor PT, and I tried opening a department. I tried starting a program there in the hospital, and unfortunately, the doctors just weren't sending the clients. And you'd think it's like a no-brainer. If you work in a hospital and you have a relationship with the doctors, and you would think like automatically. But I think despite trying to educate them about how helpful we could be towards their patients, it just didn't click.
And then it becomes, it goes to the oblivious place, and it may happen.
Yeah. Do you practice in New Jersey or just in New York?
At present, I only practice in New York. I did renew my New Jersey license with the goal of perhaps potentially down the road opening something in New Jersey. For now, in Washington Heights, which is right over the bridge, and Upper West Side.
Yeah. And this is your company. This is not like a franchise physical therapy.
No, this is me. This is me. Yeah, you all got little revitalized PT trigger point balls today. It's my swag I brought in for you guys. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Thank you.
Very, very, very helpful.
Yeah. Thank you. I hope that this information was relevant and helpful.